Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell Reed, my co-hosts Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Marnie Bickle. Each week we visit with a local author who is sometimes, as this week, a musician and teacher as well. We hope to find out a little about her life, what prompts her to write, and give her an opportunity to read some of her work for us. We are very pleased to have Marnie with us today. Welcome, Marnie.
Thank you.
Marnie Hare Bickle has been fascinated by words and music for as long as she can remember. She studied piano and voice and taught herself to play the guitar so she could perform her own songs at school, church, and community events. She wrote her first poem for her parents when she was 8 years old. Her work in early childhood education sparked her interest in children's literature, and she used her own poems and songs for teaching. She's written many articles about Canadian musicians and composers, and a book, Opera and the University of Toronto, which chronicles the second 25 years of the school for its 50th anniversary. Though she now runs a music studio with over 35 students in Port Hope, she has also found time to rewrite and edit the memoirs of John David Ford, a relative of her husband's, whose long-forgotten memoirs were found in the attic of her home. So, tell us about these memoirs, Marnie. Was John David Ford a close relative? How did the manuscripts end up in your possession?
John David Ford, and by David Ford, once he moved to Port Hope, he was remarried to my husband's cousin, Ruth Hawkins Ford. At 91, Ruth decided she wanted to try a retirement home for the winter. And it's a long story, but we ended up being able to buy her home. And the auctioneer didn't bother to empty the attic. So when we went into the attic, we found a lot of dirt and dead flies and ladybugs, but also these wonderful manuscripts.
It must be really exciting. Everybody always wants to find a treasure in the attic. So what happened when you uncovered them? Did you sit down and read them right away?
After I cleared the filth away and dusted them off, there were so many manuscripts, some of them handwritten in school booklets, some of them typed on cheap newsprint, some of them typed on onion skin. I really had to sort them all first. Then once I got them in some kind of order, I realized that he had written several copies of many of his early memoirs. So it was a matter of piecing them together. And yes, I did read bits and pieces. I still haven't read some of them.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm working my way through. But yes, I certainly did read them.
Okay. So I know he had an interesting life, David Ford. Can you tell us some of the details and what made you want to rewrite the memoirs?
He had already passed away when I came on the scene, but mm-hmm. He was certainly family folklore. People really didn't take him very seriously. They thought his tales were just that, tall tales written for the youngster, well, told to the youngsters. I don't even think they knew he had written them down. So when I found the memoirs, I first of all wanted to really discover if they were true.
Mm-hmm.
So that took a lot of research. Then I also wanted to find out, did he really meet Ruth from a letter that was placed in a sock that was knit by the Red Cross and sent to the front as part of the war effort? That's another program. And I also then wanted to know why the Inuit carvings and works that we had bought from Ruth when we bought the house didn't have any of the proper government seal on the bottom of them.
Yes.
Have these been stolen or whatever? Of course, what I found out was that these works were all bought way before those tags were.
I was going to say, I guess that.
Yeah, they were very early pieces.
Yes.
So that was what prompted me to get going on them.
Uh-huh. The manuscripts you found, there are various kinds. One of the collections was letters, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
I found a whole box of letters. They were all the letters from the war. The first tentative letter back to this lady in Port Hope, wondering why she was writing a stranger, right till the end of the war when he wrote her to say, if it wasn't for you, I never would have made it to the end of this war, and would you marry me?
But don't tell me too much, okay. Because I know in the second part we're going to hear some more about the collection.
All right.
So would you like to read from one of the memoirs?
Yes. I'm going to read from Coates Island, which is his first memoir. This goes from when he was born until he was 12 years old. He was born in 1910. So I just want to say up front that we use the word Eskimo at this point. They haven't used the word Inuit yet. So this is the piece called Waiting for the Supply Ship. The Hudson's Bay Company sent out a supply ship once a year to its few scattered trading posts in the East Arctic to replenish dwindling provisions in exchange for the valuable furs the Eskimo trapped during the winter months. We had no way of knowing when the supply ship would arrive. There was no radio communication with the outside world at that time. We children knew the adult stories of being down to the last tin of baking powder, last pound of black tea, and watching the horizon anxiously for signs of a white sail. Some years the ship didn't arrive. Any supplies that remained were strictly rationed, and our families survived on fresh meat caught by the Eskimos. No child today would be expected to do without milk. But when the supply ship didn't arrive, the little ones existed on sweetened rolled oat, simmered all night, and fed to them from a large liniment bottle topped with a nipple made from caribou hide. It was early fall, and almost too late for the ship to reach us. I was a growing, hungry, 8-year-old boy, and our larder was beginning to look skimpy and bare. Until now, I had been unaware of the dangerous consequences of a year without a visit from the supply ship. Hasty preparations were made for an excursion to nearby Duck Island for eggs. Another group was organizing a seal, bear, and walrus hunt, while still another group was planning a trek over the barren land to hunt caribou. As a result of these efforts, we had plenty of fresh meat, but the food we needed to supplement our meat diet was lacking. How we longed for the staples brought by the supply ship, flour, tea, sugar, canned milk, and dried fruits. My mother rationed the remaining small amount of flour, and after each batch of bread carefully laid aside a small portion of the dough. Our yeast supply had been used up months ago. I was hunting ducks one day, trying to do my part to help stock our meat supply. I crossed a small marsh, climbed a steep rocky hill, and as I looked over the valley and bay, I saw a huge white square rigger sailing straight for our harbor. Our long-awaited supply ship at last, as majestic a ship as you would ever want to see. Many Eskimos started running to the water's edge, and I ran down the hill and back to the settlement. The huskies howled, and my mother shed a few grateful tears. The excitement was contagious, and we all gave a sigh of relief as the rattling chain preceded the splash of the anchor. The supply schooner came to a gentle halt. The anchor held firm, and the sails fluttered down as though falling from the sky. Already my father and the Eskimos had pushed the whaleboat off the beach and were rowing to the ship to start unloading supplies. Back and forth, until the beach was full of cases and huge packing crates containing all we would need for the year. The unloading went on through the night and the next day. The food supplies, bales of cloth, and packing cases all had a half-moldy, half-scented smell as if they had been stored on the ship for a long time. The barrels of molasses dripped from being rolled over and over, and we children gathered like bees to catch the drips and lick our fingers clean of the sweet nectar. I couldn't wait to sample the biscuits from England, canned and dried fruits and assorted chocolates. First, the ship had to be loaded with valuable furs to be sold in England and other European countries. I was eager to wager some exchanges of my own. Some ivory carvings for real money. I bargained with the tough-looking sailors until I was sure I could not get one more cent from them. If they hesitated, I asked, "Where else, sir, could you expect to buy such carvings of exquisite beauty?" Indeed, where else could these fellows find Eskimo carvings in 1918 except in the Arctic? Once everything was loaded, my father gave the skipper our year's worth of outgoing mail, and we bade the captain and ship farewell.
That is marvelous, marvelous, Marnie.
It is quite exciting.
Yes, it's terrific. Mm-hmm. Gosh, thank you very much. For now, we'll take a short break.